Wind spoke in his mind. You can't choose your parentage, but you can choose your legacy. Jason felt like he was being reassembled one layer at a time. His heartbeat steadied. The chill left his bones. His skin warmed in the afternoon sun. No! He croaked. He glanced at Annabeth and Piper. My loyalties haven't changed. My family has just expanded. I'm a child of Greece and Rome. He looked back at his mother for the last time. I'm no child of yours. He made the ancient sign of warding off evil. Three fingers thrust out from the heart, and the ghost of Beryl Grace disappeared with a soft hiss, like a sigh of relief. The ghoul Antinous tossed aside his goblet. He studied Jason with a lazy look of disgust.
Well then, he said, I suppose we'll just kill you.
All around Jason, the enemies closed in. Chapter 4. Jason. The fight was going great, until he got stabbed. Jason slashed his gladius in a wide arc, vaporizing the nearest suitors. Then he vaulted onto the table and jumped right over Antinous's head. In mid-air, he willed his blade to extend into a javelin, a trick he'd never tried with this sword, but somehow he knew it would work. He landed on his feet, holding a 6-foot-long pilum. As Antinous turned to face him, Jason thrust the imperial gold point through the ghoul's chest. Antinous looked down incredulously.
You!
Enjoy the fields of punishment. Jason yanked out his pilum, and Antinous crumbled to dirt. Jason kept fighting, spinning his javelin, slicing through ghosts, knocking ghouls off their feet. Across the courtyard, Annabeth fought like a demon, too. Her dragonbone sword scythed down any suitor stupid enough to face her. Over by the sand fountain, Piper had also drawn her sword, the jagged bronze blade she'd taken from Zethys the Boread. She stabbed and parried with her right hand, occasionally shooting tomatoes from the cornucopia in her left, while yelling at the suitors, "Save yourselves! I'm too dangerous!" That must have been exactly what they wanted to hear, because her opponents kept running away, only to freeze in confusion a few yards downhill, then charge back into the fight. The Greek tyrant Hippias lunged at Piper, his dagger raised, but Piper blasted him point-blank in the chest with a lovely pot roast. He tumbled backward into the fountain and screamed as he disintegrated. An arrow whistled toward Jason's face. He blew it aside with a gust of wind, then cut through a line of sword-wielding ghouls and noticed a dozen suitors regrouping by the fountain to charge Annabeth. He lifted his javelin to the sky. A bolt of lightning ricocheted off the point and blasted the ghosts to ions, leaving a smoking crater where the earthen fountain had been. Over the last few months, Jason had fought many battles, but he'd forgotten what it was like to feel good in combat. Of course, he was still afraid, but a huge weight had been lifted from his shoulders. For the first time since waking up in Arizona with his memories erased, Jason felt whole. He knew who he was. He had chosen his family, and it had nothing to do with Beryl Grace or even Jupiter. His family included all the demigods who fought at his side, Roman and Greek, new friends and old. He wasn't going to let anyone break his family apart. He summoned the winds and tossed three ghouls off the side of the hill like rag dolls. He skewered a fourth, then willed his javelin to shrink back to a sword and hacked through another group of spirits. Soon, no more enemies faced him. The remaining ghosts began to disappear on their own. Annabeth cut down Hasdrubal the Carthaginian, and Jason made the mistake of sheathing his sword. Pain flared in his lower back. so sharp and cold he thought Kioni, the snow goddess, had touched him. Next to his ear, Michael Varus snarled, "Born a Roman, die a Roman." The tip of a golden sword jutted through the front of Jason's shirt, just below his ribcage. Jason fell to his knees. Piper's scream sounded miles away. He felt like he'd been immersed in salty water, his body weightless, his head swaying. Piper charged toward him. He watched with detached emotion as her sword passed over his head and cut through Michael Varus's armor with a metallic ka-chunk. A burst of cold parted Jason's hair from behind. Dust settled around him, and an empty legionnaire's helmet rolled across the stones. The evil demigod was gone, but he had made a lasting impression.
"Jason!"
Piper grabbed his shoulders as he began to fall sideways. He gasped as she pulled the sword out of his back. Then she lowered him to the ground, propping his head against the stone. Annabeth ran to their side. She had a nasty cut on the side of her neck.
"Gods!"
Annabeth stared at the wound in Jason's gut.
"Oh, gods!"
"Thanks," Jason groaned. "I was afraid it might be bad."
His arms and legs started to tingle as his body went into crisis mode, sending all the blood to his chest. The pain was dull, which surprised him, but his shirt was soaked red. The wound was smoking. He was pretty sure sword wounds weren't supposed to smoke.
"You're going to be fine."
Piper spoke the words like an order. Her tone steadied his breathing.
"Annabeth! Ambrosia!"
Annabeth stirred.
Yeah, I got it."
She ripped through her supply pouch and unwrapped a piece of godly food.
"We have to stop the bleeding."
Piper used her dagger to cut fabric from the bottom of her dress. She ripped the cloth into bandages. Jason dimly wondered how she knew so much first aid. She wrapped the wounds on his back and stomach while Annabeth pushed tiny bites of ambrosia into his mouth. Annabeth's fingers trembled. After all the things she'd been through, Jason found it odd that she would freak out now while Piper acted so calm. Then it occurred to him, Annabeth could afford to be scared for him. Piper couldn't. She was completely focused on trying to save him. Annabeth fed him another bite.
"Jason, I'm sorry about your mom, but the way you handled it, that was so brave."
Jason tried not to close his eyes. Every time he did, he saw his mom's spirit disintegrating.
"It wasn't her," he said. "At least, no part of her I could save. There was no other choice."
Annabeth took a shaky breath.
"No other right choice, maybe, but a friend of mine, Luke, his mom, similar problem. He didn't handle it as well."
Her voice broke. Jason didn't know much about Annabeth's past, but Piper glanced over in concern.
"I've bandaged as much as I can," she said. "Blood is still soaking through. And the smoke. I don't get that." "Imperial gold," Annabeth said, her voice quavering. "It's deadly to demigods. It's only a matter of time before..."
"He'll be all right," Piper insisted. "We've got to get him back to the ship." "I don't feel that bad," Jason said.
And it was true. The ambrosia had cleared his head. Warmth was seeping back into his limbs.
"Maybe I could fly."
Jason sat up. His vision turned a pale shade of green.
"Or maybe not."
Piper caught his shoulders as he keeled sideways.
"Whoa, Sparky. We need to contact the Argo II. Get help."
"You haven't called me Sparky in a long time."
Piper kissed his forehead.
"Stick with me and I'll insult you all you want."
Annabeth scanned the ruins.
The magic veneer had faded, leaving only broken walls and excavation pits.
We could use the emergency flares, but...
No, Jason said. Leah would blast the top of the hill with Greek fire. Maybe if you guys help me, I could walk.
Absolutely not, Piper objected. That would take too long.
She rummaged in her belt pouch and pulled out a compact mirror.
Annabeth, you know Morse code?
Of course.
So does Leo.
Piper handed her the mirror.
He'll be watching from the ship. Go to the ridge.
And flash him.
Annabeth's face reddened.
That came out wrong, but yeah, good idea.
She ran to the edge of the ruins. Piper pulled out a flask of nectar and gave Jason a sip.
Hang in there. You are not dying from a stupid body piercing.
Jason managed a weak smile.
At least it wasn't a head injury this time. I stayed conscious the entire fight.
You defeated like 200 enemies, Piper said. You were scary amazing.
You guys helped.
Maybe, but... Hey, stay with me.
Jason's head started to droop. The cracks in the stones came into sharper focus.
Little dizzy, he muttered.
More nectar, Piper ordered. There. Taste okay?
Yeah. Yeah, fine.
In fact, the nectar tasted like liquid sawdust, but Jason kept that to himself. Ever since the House of Hades, when he'd resigned his praetorship, ambrosia and nectar didn't taste like his favorite foods from Camp Jupiter. It was as if the memory of his old home no longer had the power to heal him.
Born a Roman, die a Roman, Michael Varus had said.
He looked at the smoke curling from his bandages. He had worse things to worry about than blood loss. Annabeth was right about imperial gold. The stuff was deadly to demigods as well as monsters. The wound from Varus's blade would do its best to eat away at Jason's life force. He'd seen a demigod die like that once before. It hadn't been fast or pretty.
I can't die, he told himself. My friends are depending on me.
Antinous's words rang in his ears, about the giants in Athens, the impossible trip facing the Argo II, the mysterious hunter Gia had sent to intercept the Athena Parthenos.
Reyna, Nico, and Coach Hedge, he said. They're in danger. We need to warn them.
We'll take care of it when we get back to the ship, Piper promised. Your job right now is to relax.
Her tone was light and confident, but her eyes brimmed with tears.
Besides, those three are a tough group. They'll be fine.
Jason hoped she was right. Reyna had risked so much to help them. Coach Hedge was annoying sometimes, but he'd been a loyal protector for the entire crew. And Nico. Jason felt especially worried about him. Piper brushed her thumb against the scar on his lip.
Once the war is over, everything will work out for Nico. You've done what you could, being a friend to him.
Jason wasn't sure what to say. He hadn't told Piper anything about his conversations with Nico. He'd kept D'Angelo's secret. Still, Piper seemed to sense what was wrong. As a daughter of Aphrodite, maybe she could tell when somebody was struggling with heartache. She hadn't pressured Jason to talk about it, though. He appreciated that. Another wave of pain made him wince.
Concentrate on my voice.
Piper kissed his forehead.
Think about something good. Birthday cake in the park in Rome.
That was nice.
Last winter, she suggested. The s'mores fight at the campfire?
I totally got you.
You had marshmallows in your hair for days.
I did not.
Jason's mind drifted back to better times. He just wanted to stay there, talking with Piper, holding her hand, not worrying about giants or Gia or his mother's madness. He knew they should get back to the ship. He was in bad shape. They had the information they'd come for, but as he lay there on the cool stones, Jason felt a sense of incompleteness. The story of the suitors and Queen Penelope, his thoughts about family, his recent dreams. Those things all swirled around in his head. There was something more to this place, something he'd missed. Annabeth came back limping from the edge of the hill.
"Are you hurt?" Jason asked her.
Annabeth glanced at her ankle.
"It's fine. Just the old break from the Roman caverns. Sometimes when I'm stressed..." "That's not important. I signaled Leo. Frank's going to change form, fly up here, and carry you back to the ship. I need to make a litter to keep you stable."
Jason had a terrifying image of himself in a hammock, swinging between the claws of Frank the giant eagle, but he decided it would be better than dying. Annabeth set to work. She collected scraps left behind by the suitors, a leather belt, a torn tunic, sandal straps, a red blanket, and a couple of broken spear shafts. Her hands flew across the materials, ripping, weaving, tying, braiding.
"How are you doing that?" Jason asked in amazement.
"Learned it during my quest under Rome."
Annabeth kept her eyes on her work.
"I'd never had a reason to try weaving before, but it's handy for certain things, like getting away from spiders."
She tied off one last bit of leather cord and voila, a stretcher large enough for Jason, with spear shafts as carrying handles and safety straps across the middle. Piper whistled appreciatively.
"The next time I need a dress altered, I'm coming to you."
"Shut up, McLean,"
Annabeth said, but her eyes glinted with satisfaction.
"Now let's get him secured."
"Wait,"
Jason said. His heart pounded. Watching Annabeth weave the makeshift bed, Jason had remembered the story of Penelope, how she'd held out for 20 years, waiting for her husband, Odysseus, to return.
"A bed," Jason said. "There was a special bed in this palace."
Piper looked worried.
"Jason, you've lost a lot of blood."
"I'm not hallucinating," he insisted. "The marriage bed was sacred. If there was any place you could talk to Juno..."
He took a deep breath and called,
"Juno!"
Silence. Maybe Piper was right. He wasn't thinking clearly. Then, about 60 feet away, the stone floor cracked. Branches muscled through the earth, growing in fast motion until a full-sized olive tree shaded the courtyard. Under a canopy of gray-green leaves stood a dark-haired woman in a white dress, a leopard-skin cape draped over her shoulders. Her staff was topped with a white lotus flower. Her expression was cool and regal.
"My heroes," said the goddess.
"Hera,"
Piper said.
"Juno,"
Jason corrected.
"Whatever,"
Annabeth grumbled.
"What are you doing here, your bovine majesty?"
Juno's dark eyes glittered dangerously.
"Annabeth Chase, as charming as ever."
"Yeah, well,"
Annabeth said,
"I just got back from Tartarus, so my manners are a little rusty, especially toward goddesses who wiped my boyfriend's memory, made him disappear for months, and then..."
"Honestly, child, are we going to rehash this again?
Aren't you supposed to be suffering from split personality disorder?"
Annabeth asked.
"I mean, more so than usual?"
"Whoa,"
Jason interceded. He had plenty of reasons to hate Juno, but they had other issues to deal with.
"Juno, we need your help. We..."
Jason tried to sit up and immediately regretted it. His insides felt like they were being twirled on a giant spaghetti fork. Piper kept him from falling over.
"First things first," she said. Jason is hurt. Heal him.
The goddess knit her eyebrows. Her form shimmered unsteadily.
Some things even the gods cannot heal, she said. This wound touches your soul as well as your body. You must fight it, Jason Grace. You must survive.
Yeah, thanks, he said, his mouth dry. I'm trying.
What do you mean the wound touches his soul? Piper demanded. Why can't you... My heroes, our time together is short, Juno said. I am grateful that you called upon me. I have spent weeks in a state of pain and confusion, my Greek and Roman natures warring against each other. Worse, I have been forced to hide from Jupiter, who searches for me in his misguided wrath, believing that I caused this war with Gia.
Gee, Annabeth said, why would he think that?
Juno flashed her an irritated look.
Fortunately, this place is sacred to me. By clearing away those ghosts, you have purified it and given me a moment of clarity. I will be able to speak with you, if only briefly.
Why is it sacred?
Piper's eyes widened.
Oh, the marriage bed.
Marriage bed?
Annabeth asked.
I don't see any...
The bed of Penelope and Odysseus, Piper explained. One of its bedposts was a living olive tree, so it could never be moved.
Indeed.
Juno ran her hand along the olive tree's trunk.
An immovable marriage bed. Such a beautiful symbol. Like Penelope, the most faithful wife, standing her ground, fending off 100 arrogant suitors for years because she knew her husband would return. Odysseus and Penelope, the epitome of a perfect marriage.
Even in his dazed state, Jason was pretty sure he remembered stories about Odysseus falling for other women during his travels, but he decided not to bring that up.
Can you advise us, at least? He asked. Tell us what to do?
Sail around the Peloponnese, said the goddess. As you suspect, that is the only possible route. On your way, seek out the goddess of victory in Olympia. She is out of control. Unless you can subdue her, the rift between Greek and Roman can never be healed.
You mean Nike?
Annabeth asked.
How is she out of control?
Thunder boomed overhead, shaking the hill.
Explaining would take too long, Juno said. I must flee before Jupiter finds me. Once I leave, I will not be able to help you again.
Jason bit back a retort. When did you help me the first time?
What else should we know? He asked.
As you heard, the giants have gathered in Athens. Few gods will be able to help you on your journey. But I am not the only Olympian who is out of favor with Jupiter. The twins have also incurred his wrath.
Artemis and Apollo? Piper asked. Why?
Juno's image began to fade.
If you reach the island of Delos, they might be prepared to help you. They are desperate enough to try anything to make amends. Go now. Perhaps we will meet again in Athens if you succeed. If you do not...
The goddess disappeared, or maybe Jason's eyesight simply failed. Pain rolled through him. His head lolled back. He saw a giant eagle circling high above. Then the blue sky turned black, and Jason saw nothing at all. Chapter 5. Reyna. Dive-bombing a volcano was not on Reyna's bucket list. Her first view of southern Italy was from 5,000 feet in the air. To the west, along the crescent of the Gulf of Naples, the lights of sleeping cities glittered in the pre-dawn gloom. 1,000 feet below her, A half-mile-wide caldera yawned at the top of a mountain, white steam pluming from the center. Reyna's disorientation took a moment to subside. Shadow travel left her groggy and nauseous, as if she'd been dragged from the cold waters of the frigidarium into the sauna at a Roman bathhouse. Then she realized she was suspended in midair. Gravity took hold, and she began to fall.
"Nico!"
she yelled.
"Pan's pipes!"
cursed Gleason.
"Whoa!"
Nico flailed, almost slipping out of Reyna's grip. She held tight and grabbed Coach Hedge by the shirt collar as he started to tumble away. If they got separated now, they were dead. They plummeted toward the volcano as their largest piece of luggage, the 40-foot-tall Athena Parthenos, trailed after them, leashed to a harness on Nico's back like a very ineffective parachute.
"That's Vesuvius below us,"
Reyna shouted over the wind.
"Nico, teleport us out of here."
His eyes were wild and unfocused. His dark, feathery hair whipped around his face like a raven shot out of the sky.
I can't. No strength.
Coach Hedge bleated.
"Newsflash, kid. Goats can't fly. Zap us out of here or we're gonna get flattened into an Athena Parthenos omelet."
Reyna tried to think. She could accept death if she had to, but if the Athena Parthenos was destroyed, their quest would fail. Reyna could not accept that.
"Nico, shadow travel," she ordered. "I'll lend you my strength."
He stared at her blankly.
"How? Do it!"
She tightened her grip on his hand. The torch and sword symbol of Bellona on her forearm grew painfully hot, as if it were being seared into her skin for the first time. Nico gasped. Color returned to his face. Just before they hit the volcano's steam plume, they slipped into shadows. The air turned frigid. The sound of the wind was replaced by a cacophony of voices whispering in a thousand languages. Reyna's insides felt like a giant piragua. Cold syrup trickled over crushed ice. Her favorite treat from childhood in Viejo San Juan. She wondered why that memory would surface now, when she was on the verge of death. Then her vision cleared. Her feet rested on solid ground. The eastern sky had begun to lighten. For a moment, Reyna thought she was back in New Rome. Doric columns lined an atrium the size of a baseball diamond. In front of her, a bronze faun stood in the middle of a sunken fountain decorated with mosaic tile. Crepe myrtles and rose bushes bloomed in a nearby garden. Palm trees and pines stretched skyward. Cobblestone paths led from the courtyard in several directions. Straight, level roads of good Roman construction, edging low stone houses with colonnaded porches. Reyna turned. Behind her, the Athena Parthenos stood intact and upright, dominating the courtyard like a ridiculously oversized lawn ornament. The little bronze faun in the fountain had both his arms raised, facing Athena, so he seemed to be cowering in fear of the new arrival. On the horizon, Mount Vesuvius loomed, a dark, humpbacked shape now several miles away. Thick pillars of steam curled from the crest.
"We're in Pompeii,"
Reyna realized.
"Oh, that's not good,"
Nico said, and immediately he collapsed.
"Whoa!"
Coach Hedge caught him before he hit the ground. The satyr propped him against Athena's feet and loosened the harness that attached Nico to the statue. Reyna's own knees buckled. She'd expected some backlash. It happened every time she shared her strength. But she hadn't anticipated so much raw anguish from Nico D'Angelo. She sat down heavily, just managing to stay conscious.
Gods of Rome.
If this was only a portion of Nico's pain, how could he bear it? She tried to steady her breathing while Coach Hedge rummaged through his camping supplies. Around Nico's boots, the stones cracked. Dark seams radiated outward like a shotgun blast of ink, as if Nico's body were trying to expel all the shadows he'd traveled through. Yesterday had been worse. An entire meadow withering, skeletons rising from the earth. Reyna wasn't anxious for that to happen again.
Drink something.
She offered him a canteen of unicorn draft, powdered horn mixed with sanctified water from the little Tiber. They'd found it worked on Nico better than nectar, helping to cleanse the fatigue and darkness from his system with less danger of spontaneous combustion. Nico gulped it down. He still looked terrible. His skin had a bluish tint. His cheeks were sunken. Hanging at his side, the scepter of Diocletian glowed angry purple, like a radioactive bruise. He studied Reyna.
How did you do that? That surge of energy?
Reyna turned her forearm. The tattoo still burned like hot wax. The symbol of Bellona, SPQR, with four lines for her years of service.
I don't like to talk about it, she said, but it's a power from my mother. I can impart strength to others.
Coach Hedge looked up from his rucksack.
Seriously? Why haven't you hooked me up, Roman girl? I want super muscles.
Reyna frowned.
It doesn't work like that, Coach. I can only do it in life-and-death situations, and it's more useful in large groups. When I command troops, I can share whatever attributes I have, strength, courage, endurance, multiplied by the size of my forces.
Nico arched an eyebrow.
Useful for a Roman praetor.
Reyna didn't answer. She preferred not to speak of her power for this exact reason. She didn't want the demigods under her command to think she was controlling them, or that she'd become a leader because she had some special magic. She could only share the qualities she already possessed, and she couldn't help anyone who wasn't worthy of being a hero. Coach Hedge grunted.
Too bad. Super muscles would be nice.
He went back to sorting through his pack, which seemed to hold a bottomless supply of cooking utensils, survivalist gear, and random sports equipment. Nico took another swig of unicorn draft. His eyes were heavy with exhaustion, but Reyna could tell he was fighting to stay awake.
You stumbled just now,
he noticed.
When you use your power, do you get some sort of, feedback from me?
It's not mind reading, she said. Not even an empathy link. Just a temporary wave of exhaustion. Primal emotions. Your pain washes over me. I take on some of your burden.
Nico's expression became guarded. He twisted the silver skull ring on his finger, the same way Reyna did with her silver ring when she was thinking. Sharing a habit with the son of Hades made her uneasy. She'd felt more pain from Nico in their brief connection than she had from her entire legion during the battle against the giant Polybetes. It had drained her worse than the last time she'd used her power, to sustain her Pegasus, Scipio, during their journey across the Atlantic. She tried to push away that memory. Her brave wing friend, dying from poison, his muzzle in her lap, looking at her trustingly as she raised her dagger to end his misery. Gods, no. She couldn't dwell on that or it would break her. But the pain she'd felt from Nico was sharper.
You should rest, she told him. After two jumps in a row, even with a little help, you're lucky to be alive. We'll need you to be ready again by nightfall.
She felt bad asking him to do something so impossible. Unfortunately, she'd had a lot of practice pushing demigods beyond their limits. Nico clenched his jaw and nodded.
We're stuck here now.
He scanned the ruins.
But Pompeii is the last place I would have chosen to land. This place is full of lemurs.
Lemurs? Coach Hedge seemed to be making some sort of snare out of kite string, a tennis racket, and a hunting knife.
You mean those cute, fuzzy critters? No.
Nico sounded annoyed, like he got that question a lot.
Lemuris. Unfriendly ghosts. All Roman cities have them, but in Pompeii...
The whole city was wiped out, Reyna remembered, in 79 CE. Vesuvius erupted and covered the town in ash.
Nico nodded.
A tragedy like that creates a lot of angry spirits.
Coach Hedge eyed the distant volcano.
It's steaming. Is that a bad sign? I'm not sure.
Nico picked at a hole in the knee of his black jeans.
Mountain gods, the Ori, can sense children of Hades. It's possible that's why we were pulled off course. The spirit of Vesuvius might have been trying intentionally to kill us, but I doubt the mountain can hurt us this far away. Working up to a full eruption would take too long. The immediate threat is all around us.
The back of Reyna's neck tingled. She'd grown used to Larry's, the friendly spirits at Camp Jupiter, but even they made her uneasy. They didn't have a good understanding of personal space. Sometimes they'd walk right through her, leaving her with vertigo. Being in Pompeii gave Reyna the same feeling, as if the whole city was one big ghost that had swallowed her whole. She couldn't tell her friends how much she feared ghosts, or why she feared them. The whole reason she and her sister had run away from San Juan all those years ago. That secret had to stay buried.
"Can you keep them at bay?"
she asked.
Nico turned up his palms. "I've sent out that message. Stay away. But once I'm asleep, it won't do us much good."
Coach Hedge patted his tennis racket knife contraption.
"Don't worry, kid. I'm going to line the perimeter with alarms and snares. Plus, I'll be watching over you the whole time with my baseball bat."
That didn't seem to reassure Nico, but his eyes were already half closed.
"Okay, but go easy. We don't want another Albania."
"No,"
Reyna agreed. Their first shadow travel experience together, 2 days ago, had been a total fiasco. Possibly the most humiliating episode in Reyna's long career. Perhaps someday, if they survived, they would look back on it and laugh. But not now. The three of them had agreed never to speak of it. What happened in Albania would stay in Albania. Coach Hedge looked hurt.
"Fine, whatever. Just rest, kid. We got you covered." "All right,"
Nico relented.
"Maybe a little."
He managed to take off his aviator jacket and wad it into a pillow before he keeled over and began to snore. Reyna marveled at how peaceful he looked. The worry lines vanished. His face became strangely angelic, like his surname, D'Angelo. She could almost believe he was a regular 14-year-old boy, not a son of Hades who had been pulled out of time from the 1940s and forced to endure more tragedy and danger than most demigods would in a lifetime. When Nico had arrived at Camp Jupiter, Reyna didn't trust him. She'd sensed there was more to his story than being an ambassador from his father, Pluto. Now, of course, she knew the truth. He was a Greek demigod, the first person in living memory, perhaps the first ever, to go back and forth between the Roman and Greek camps without telling either group that the other existed. Strangely, that made Reyna trust Nico more. Sure, he wasn't Roman. He'd never hunted with Lupa or endured the brutal legion training. But Nico had proven himself in other ways. He'd kept the camp's secrets for the best of reasons, because he feared a war. He had plunged into Tartarus alone, voluntarily, to find the doors of death. He'd been captured and imprisoned by giants. He had led the crew of the Argo II into the House of Hades. And now, he had accepted yet another terrible quest, risking himself to haul the Athena Parthenos back to Camp Half-Blood. The pace of the journey was maddeningly slow. They could only shadow travel a few hundred miles each night, resting during the day to let Nico recover. But even that required more stamina from Nico than Reyna would have thought possible. He carried so much sadness and loneliness, so much heartache. Yet he put his mission first. He persevered. Reyna respected that. She understood that. She'd never been a touchy-feely person, but she had the strangest desire to drape her cloak over Nico's shoulders and tuck him in. She mentally chided herself. He was a comrade, not her little brother. He wouldn't appreciate the gesture.
"Hey!" Coach Hedge interrupted her thoughts. "You need sleep, too. I'll take first watch and cook some grub. Those ghosts shouldn't be too dangerous now that the sun's coming up."
Reyna hadn't noticed how light it was getting. Pink and turquoise clouds striped the eastern horizon. The little bronze fawn cast a shadow across the dry fountain.
"I've read about this place," Reyna realized. "It's one of the best preserved villas in Pompeii. They call it the House of the Fawn."
Gleason glanced at the statue with distaste.
"Yeah, well, today it's the House of the Satyr."
Reyna managed a smile. She was starting to appreciate the differences between satyrs and fawns. If she ever fell asleep with a fawn on duty, she'd wake up with her supplies stolen, a mustache drawn on her face, and the fawn long gone. Coach Hedge was different. Mostly good different, though he did have an unhealthy obsession with martial arts and baseball bats.
"All right," she agreed. "You take first watch. I'll put Aram and Argentum on guard duty with you."
Hedge looked like he wanted to protest, but Reyna whistled sharply. The metallic greyhounds materialized from the ruins, racing toward her from different directions. Even after so many years, Reyna had no idea where they came from or where they went when she dismissed them, but seeing them lifted her spirits. Hedge cleared his throat.
"You sure those aren't Dalmatians? They look like Dalmatians."
"They're greyhounds, Coach."
Reyna had no idea why Hedge feared Dalmatians, but she was too tired to ask right now.
"Aram, Argentum, guard us while I sleep. Obey Gleason Hedge."
The dogs circled the courtyard, keeping their distance from the Athena Parthenos, which radiated hostility toward everything Roman. Reyna herself was only now getting used to it, and she was pretty sure the statue did not appreciate being relocated in the middle of an ancient Roman city. She lay down and pulled her purple cloak over herself. Her fingers curled around the pouch at her belt, where she kept the silver coin Annabeth had given her before they parted company in Epirus.
"It's a sign that things can change," Annabeth had told her. "The mark of Athena is yours now. Maybe the coin will bring you luck."
Whether that luck would be good or bad, Reyna wasn't sure. She took one last look at the bronze fawn cowering before the sunrise and the Athena Parthenos. Then she closed her eyes and slipped into dreams. Chapter 6. Reyna. Most of the time, Reyna could control her nightmares. She had trained her mind to start all her dreams in her favorite place, the Garden of Bacchus, on the tallest hill in New Rome. She felt safe and tranquil there. When visions invaded her sleep, as they always did with demigods, she could contain them by imagining they were reflections in the garden's fountain. This allowed her to sleep peacefully and avoid waking up the next morning in a cold sweat. Tonight, however, she wasn't so lucky. The dream began well enough. She stood in the garden on a warm afternoon, the arbor heavy with blooming honeysuckle. In the central fountain, the little statue of Bacchus spouted water into the basin. The golden domes and red-tiled roofs of New Rome spread out below her. Half a mile west rose the fortifications of Camp Jupiter. Beyond that, the little Tiber curved gently around the valley, tracing the edge of the Berkeley Hills, hazy and golden in the summer light. Raina held a cup of hot chocolate, her favorite drink. She exhaled contentedly. This place was worth defending, for herself, for her friends, for all demigods. Her 4 years at Camp Jupiter hadn't been easy, but they'd been the best time of Raina's life. Suddenly the horizon darkened. Raina thought it might be a storm. Then she realized a tidal wave of dark loam was rolling across the hills, turning the skin of the earth inside out, leaving nothing behind. Raina watched in horror as the earthen tide reached the edge of the valley. The god Terminus sustained a magical barrier around the camp, but it slowed the destruction for only a moment. Purple light sprayed upward like shattered glass, and the tide poured through, shredding trees, destroying roads, wiping the little Tiber off the map. "It's a vision," Raina thought. "I can control this." She tried to change the dream. She imagined that the destruction was only a reflection in the fountain, a harmless video image. But the nightmare continued in full vivid scope. The earth swallowed the field of Mars, obliterating every trace of forts and trenches from the war games. The city's aqueduct collapsed like a line of children's blocks. Camp Jupiter itself fell, watchtowers crashing down, walls and barracks disintegrating. The screams of demigods were silenced, and the earth moved on. A sob built in Raina's throat. The gleaming shrines and monuments on Temple Hill crumbled. The Colosseum and the Hippodrome were swept away. The tide of earth reached the Pomerian line and roared straight into the city. Families ran through the forum. Children cried in terror. The Senate House imploded. Villas and gardens disappeared like crops under a tiller. The tide churned uphill toward the Garden of Bacchus, the last remnant of Raina's world.
"You left them helpless, Raina Ramirez Arellano."
A woman's voice issued from the black terrain.
"Your camp will be destroyed. Your quest is a fool's errand. My hunter comes for you."
Raina tore herself from the garden railing. She ran to the Fountain of Bacchus and gripped the rim of the basin, staring desperately into the water. She willed the nightmare to become a harmless reflection.
Thunk!
The basin broke in half, split by an arrow the size of a rake. Raina stared in shock at the raven feather fletching, the shaft painted red, yellow, and black like a coral snake, the Stygian iron point embedded in her gut. She looked up through a haze of pain. At the edge of the garden, a dark figure approached. The silhouette of a man whose eyes shone like miniature headlamps, blinding Raina. She heard the scrape of iron against leather as he drew another arrow from his quiver. Then her dream changed. The garden and the hunter vanished, along with the arrow in Raina's stomach. She found herself in an abandoned vineyard. Stretched out before her, acres of dead grapevines hung in rows on wooden lattices, like gnarled miniature skeletons. At the far end of the field stood a cedar-shingled farmhouse with a wraparound porch. Beyond that, the land dropped off into the sea. Raina recognized this place, the Goldsmith Winery on the north shore of Long Island. Her scouting parties had secured it as a forward base for the Legion's assault on Camp Half-Blood. She had ordered the bulk of the Legion to remain in Manhattan until she told them otherwise, but obviously Octavian had disobeyed her. The entire 12th Legion was camped in the northernmost field. They dug in with their usual military precision, 10-foot-deep trenches and spiked earthen walls around the perimeter. a watchtower on each corner armed with ballistae. Inside, tents were arranged in neat rows of white and red. The standards of all five cohorts curled in the wind. The sight of the Legion should have lifted Reyna's spirits. It was a small force, barely 200 demigods, but they were well-trained and well-organized. If Julius Caesar came back from the dead, he would have had no trouble recognizing Reyna's troops as worthy soldiers of Rome. But they had no business being so close to Camp Half-Blood. Octavian's insubordination made Reyna clench her fists. He was intentionally provoking the Greeks, hoping for battle. Her dream vision zoomed to the porch of the farmhouse, where Octavian sat in a gilded chair that looked suspiciously like a throne. Along with his senatorial purple-lined toga, his centurion badge, and his augur's knife, he had adopted a new honor. A white cloth mantle over his head, which marked him as Pontifex Maximus, high priest to the gods. Reyna wanted to strangle him. No demigod in living memory had taken the title Pontifex Maximus. By doing so, Octavian was elevating himself almost to the level of emperor. To his right, reports and maps were strewn across a low table. To his left, a marble altar was heaped with fruit and gold offerings, no doubt for the gods. But to Reyna, it looked like an altar to Octavian himself. At his side, the Legion's eagle-bearer, Jacob, stood at attention, sweating in his lion-skin cloak, as if he held the staff with the golden eagle standard on the 12th. Octavian was in the midst of an audience. At the base of the stairs knelt a boy in jeans and a rumpled hoodie. Octavian's fellow centurion of the first cohort, Mike Cahale, stood to one side with his arms crossed, glowering with obvious displeasure. "Well now," Octavian scanned a piece of parchment, "I see here you are a legacy, a descendant of Orcus." The boy in the hoodie looked up, and Reyna caught her breath. Bryce Lawrence. She recognized his mop of brown hair, his broken nose, his cruel green eyes and smug, twisted smile. "Yes, my lord," Bryce said. "Oh, I'm not a lord." Octavian's eyes crinkled. "Just a centurion, an augur, and a humble priest doing his best to serve the gods. I understand you were dismissed from the Legion for, disciplinary problems." Reyna tried to shout, but she couldn't make a sound. Octavian knew perfectly well why Bryce had been kicked out. Much like his godly forefather, Orcus, the underworld god of punishment, Bryce was completely remorseless. The little psychopath had survived his trials with Lupa just fine, but as soon as he arrived at Camp Jupiter, he had proved to be untrainable. He had tried to set a cat on fire for fun. He had stabbed a horse and sent it stampeding through the forum. He was even suspected of sabotaging a siege engine and getting his own centurion killed during the war games. If Reyna had been able to prove it, Bryce's punishment would have been death. But because the evidence was circumstantial, and because Bryce's family was rich and powerful with lots of influence in New Rome, he'd gotten off with the lighter sentence of banishment. "Yes, Pontifex," Bryce said slowly, "but if I may, those charges were unproven. I am a loyal Roman." Mike Cahale looked like he was doing his best not to throw up. Octavian smiled. "I believe in second chances. You've responded to my call for recruits. You have the proper credentials and letters of recommendation. Do you pledge to follow my orders and serve the Legion?" "Absolutely," said Bryce. "Then you are reinstated in probatio," Octavian said, "until you have proven yourself in combat." He gestured at Mike, who reached in his pouch and fished out a lead probatio tablet on a leather cord. He hung the cord around Bryce's neck. "Report to the fifth cohort," Octavian said. "They could use some new blood, some fresh perspective. If your Centurion Dakota has any problem with that, tell him to talk to me." Bryce smiled like he'd just been handed a sharp knife.
"My pleasure."
"And Bryce?" Octavian's face looked almost ghoulish under his white mantle, his eyes too piercing, his cheeks too gaunt, his lips too thin and colorless. "However much money, power, and prestige the Lawrence family carries in the Legion, remember that my family carries more. I am personally sponsoring you, as I am sponsoring all the other new recruits. Follow my orders, and you'll advance quickly. Soon I may have a little job for you, a chance to prove your worth. But cross me, and I will not be as lenient as Reyna. Do you understand?" Bryce's smile faded. He looked like he wanted to say something, but he changed his mind. He nodded. "Good," Octavian said. "Also, get a haircut. You look like one of those Greekus scum. Dismissed." After Bryce left, Mike Kahale shook his head.
"That makes 24 now."
"It's good news, my friend," Octavian assured him. "We need the extra manpower."
"Murderers, thieves, traitors?"
"Loyal demigods," Octavian said, "who owe their position to me." Mike scowled. Until Reyna had met him, she'd never understood why people called biceps guns, but Mike's arms were as thick as bazooka barrels. He had broad features, a toasted almond complexion, onyx hair, and proud dark eyes, like the old Hawaiian kings. She wasn't sure how a high school linebacker from Hilo had wound up with Venus for a mom, but no one in the Legion gave him any grief about that. Not once they saw him crush rocks with his bare hands. Reyna had always liked Mike Kahale. Unfortunately, Mike was very loyal to his sponsor. And his sponsor was Octavian. The Pontifex rose and stretched. "Don't worry, old friend. Our siege teams have the Greek camp surrounded. Our eagles have complete air superiority. The Greeks aren't going anywhere until we're ready to strike. In 11 days, all my forces will be in place. My little surprises will be prepared. On August 1st, the Feast of Spes, the Greek camp will fall."
"But Reyna said..."
"We've been through this." Octavian slid his iron dagger from the belt and threw it at the table, where it impaled a map of Camp Half-Blood. "Reyna has forfeited her position. She went to the ancient lands, which is against the law."
"But the Earth Mother
has been stirring because of the war between the Greek and Roman camps, yes? The gods are incapacitated, yes? And how do we solve that problem, Mike? We eliminate the division. We wipe out the Greeks. We return the gods to their proper manifestation as Roman. Once the gods are restored to their full power, Gia will not dare rise. She will sink back into her slumber. We demigods will be strong and unified, as we were in the old days of the Empire. Besides, the first day of August is most auspicious, the month named after my ancestor Augustus. And you know how he united the Romans?"
"He seized power and became emperor," Mike rumbled.
Octavian waved aside the comment. "Nonsense! He saved Rome by becoming first citizen. He wanted peace and prosperity, not power. Believe me, Mike, I intend to follow his example. I will save New Rome, and when I do, I will remember my friends." Mike shifted his considerable bulk.
You sound certain. Has your gift of prophecy...
Octavian held up his hand in warning. He glanced at Jacob, the eagle-bearer, who was still standing at attention behind him.
Jacob, you're dismissed. Why don't you go polish the eagle or something?
Jacob's shoulders slumped in relief.
Yes, Aug.